Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
My name's Catherine Carr, and this is Relatively, the podcast all about potentially the longest relationships of your life.
We're all good to go, are we?
All good.
That would be the problem.
Very diplomatic, isn't he?
I'll be bringing siblings together to talk about the connections they have as adults, as well as what it was like growing up together.
I'm the only East Coaster in our family, and if anyone knows Scotland, that's a big deal.
This week we're talking to former Royal Marine JJ Chalmers and his older sister, Ruth Padmore.
Nothing annoys me more, in fairness, than losing time when you're doing a job in the workshop, whatever, because you spend half an hour looking for the tool.
That definitely came from Mum and Dad.
But I'll also talk to them separately to get a more private take on the relationship.
All I knew is I'd been clattered really badly. I remember wanting to do something about that, you know, like, right, get a tourniquet on this arm, whatever it might be. But basically both my arms had come off, so there's nothing I could do for myself.
As much as all of this is JJ and his hard work and his personality that has got him where he is today, none of it happens without a big family of supporters behind him.
And in a new twist, I'll be delving a little further back with the help of our sponsors, Find My Past, the family history experts.
Oh, according to the records?
According to the records.
No.
No.
Let's hear.
Right, let's hear then.
Brothers and sisters are never straightforward. Ruth and JJ grew up in Scotland. Ruth was born on the West Coast and JJ on the East. Their father was a vicar, and so their childhood was spent living in the manse, or vicarage. As a Marine, JJ went on tour to Afghanistan, where he was severely wounded, in a night his sister Ruth remembers very clearly. We talk about that, about supporting each other through thick and thin, and being mates with Prince Harry. But Ruth started by recalling the Christmas time that baby JJ arrived.
I remember my mum being adamant he was going to be born before Christmas. So she walked and she walked and she walked up and down Princes Street until she realised that she was in labour and it was time to go to the hospital. He came home and made his first appearance, I think, at church on Christmas morning.
Oh, and your dad's a vicar, right?
That's right. Yeah, our dad's a Church of Scotland minister. When we were little, he was like in a city centre church in Edinburgh.
So as a vicar's daughter, you're quite sort of at the heart of a particular community, aren't you? So that must have been really exciting. Like the vicar had a new baby and it was Christmas and there you were.
Yeah, yeah. It was exciting. I remember just growing up in churches as being a really friendly and warm place to be and everybody kind of looking out for you. You know, we were almost like, you know, the children of the manse. So we were very, very lucky at Christmas time with lots of little extra gifts. None of the elders or members ever forgot about us at Christmas time. So it was lovely.
It was on the outskirts of Edinburgh, overlooking the Pentland Hills on the south side. It was beautiful. It's really interesting. I remember listening to David Tennant, Doctor Who, and whatever else fame. His dad was a minister as well. In fact, worked next door to my dad. They were good friends growing up. And I remember listening to David Tennant's Desert Island Discs and just thinking, that is my childhood. And it was just the way he described things like, yeah, that it was a very busy place now and again. The manse is both your home, but it's also sort of an extension of the office, an extension of the church. So a lot of people were coming and going.
Looking back now, having been back to see it as a now 40-year-old, it's probably a wee bit smaller than I remember it being when I was a kid. When I was little, I just thought it was this very, very grand kind of house with a big fancy living room that had a glass door on it that had a key and Mum and Dad used to lock it.
It was a fancy living room that we weren't really allowed in, and that was always kept nice. But that was, you know, I understand now, because that's where the congregation came and had a cup of tea and talked about whatever they had to talk about and whatnot. Because listen, the other thing growing up as a minister's son, the one thing I will say is that you're always kind of on show. You have to, at the very least, behave yourself.
And what sort of little brother was JJ? Can you remember that?
Well, he was an energetic little boy, I think would be a good way to describe him. Always in the thick of it.
I have always been full of energy, and as is the case with my son, you've got to engage me or else I will go off and engage myself, or you need to figure out a way of, containing it.
1 year, he played the role of a jack-in-the-box in the Christmas nativity at church because my mum just needed to contain him in one place for a long time.
The famed jack-in-the-box. I think I probably knew exactly what was going on at the time as well. But yes, I was, energetic, unruly. I knew where the line was, just about.
He kept saying, is it time to get up yet? And she said, no, just stay in the box, stay in the box.
And I just sat there in this box for the whole show, just being like, is it my turn yet? Is it my turn? Do I go? Do I jump up yet? And eventually my big moment came and I got to, jump out on stage, I guess. But yeah, I do remember it well.
So then at the very end of the nativity, he got to jump out the box. So yeah, he was a lovely wee boy, but very energetic.
So was it no surprise to you when at university he decided to join the military as somewhere to put that jack-in-the-box energy?
All three of us went to boarding school for our kind of senior years, and JJ got involved in the cadet force at school, and he really grabbed that with both hands. So yeah, it was no surprise to me when he decided when he left school that he was going to join the reserves. Obviously Afghanistan had already started well before he left school, so I probably always just put it to the back of my mind that he would ever actually go to Afghanistan. It's a possibility, but I think you always just hope it's not going to come. So I will never forget being told that his papers had come up and he was going to go off to Afghanistan.
We'll come to that bit in the story in a little while, but I didn't realise you guys had gone to boarding school.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could tell me what boarding school was like.
I think all of us, if you asked us, our first thing we'd say is that we loved every minute of it. It was, for me being the oldest, I think, quite a funny time because I remember feeling a bit like a second mum to David and JJ, because I could see that both of them, having a bit of mischievousness about them, would want to get into a bit of bother, and I would be the one that would be saying, don't do this, don't do that, because you'll get a phone call home to mum and dad and then you'll get in trouble. And I definitely was a bit of the mother hen when we were away at boarding school.
Your mum's like eyes and ears remotely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she still is. That's not changed at all. I mean, she's been doing that since day dot, let's be honest about it. But that works both ways as well. Like, because she's mum's eyes and ears, she is the sort of second mum to me. And what I mean by that is, even to this day, if she asked me to do something, without even thinking twice, I would just stand up and do it. And that, as a teenager, was just sort of like, go and get my shoes. And I'd be like, absolutely. And like, I'm like, wait a minute, have you hypnotised me? How does this work? Having said that, it would be the case then, and it's definitely the case now, she would do anything for me these days, and certainly does.
I remember the day of Prince Harry's wedding, I was at home looking after his baby and my three kids and our grandma dementia, watching Prince Harry's wedding on the TV and thinking, I'm looking after his kids so he can go to this. This is really quite
seriously
bizarre. Seriously unfair, but it's, amazing. Amazing what he's
achieved. I'm sure he took you out for a slap-up champagne dinner after that, though, didn't he, Ruth?
I don't recall that, actually.
I'm going to have words. This is bad brother
behavior. Yeah, you can have words.
So some of the jack-in-the-box energy was well-directed then when you joined the cadets at boarding school and then went on to join the Marines. I wonder if you could tell me about your early army career, please.
Well, yeah, I joined the Marines when I was 17. I left school and I went on a camp with the cadets. And that's when I made the proper decision that I was going to join the Corps at that point. And came back from that, pretty much phoned up the recruiting office. And I think I was doing selection, a couple of weeks later. That was the beginning of a huge part of my life that still is to this day. I mean, when you're in an organisation like the Royal Marines, particularly from such a young age, it has such an informative place on your mindset more than anything. There isn't a facet of my life that it doesn't sort of touch, because ultimately it's the way that I think and it's the way that I, what we would call, operate. I can point to pretty much everything I do to these days, and I can see a little bit of what the Corps, not necessarily taught me, but allowed me to learn myself, which is the kind of really underpinning part of it.
I think that's really interesting, but also I'm slightly snagged on your age when you joined up. I've got a 16-year-old son, and I wonder when your energetic boy, who has all your genes and your markers, is 17, whether you'll look back on that decision to go to the office to sign up somewhat differently.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because, listen, when I was 17, it meant that my mum had to sign a piece of paper to say that I could join. I clearly remember exactly where I was when she sort of took the decision to say I could. You can't stop your children, you know, wanting to achieve their dreams. And that was my thing at the time. My mum wasn't going to stop me going for it. And she also knew that if she'd said no, I'd have just waited a year, 6 months, whatever it was, and done it anyway when I turned 18. Yeah.
So let's rewind then to when his papers did come up and he was called to go to Afghanistan. And you said that was a bit of a heart-stopping moment for you.
Yeah, it was. And I probably get a bit emotional thinking about it now. I was actually on holiday in Paris with my husband and our two kids, who at the time were just coming up for 2 and 4. And I had got them off to bed one night and they were tucked up in the little twin room in a mobile home. And my mum and dad had come to stay with us for a few days of the holiday. I went into the bedroom once the kids were sleeping and I found my mum standing in between the two beds looking down at my son in floods of tears. And I said, "What is it?" And she just looked at my son Luke and said, "That's what JJ's like to me. And now he's going to Afghanistan. He's just my little baby." And that was the first that I knew that these papers had come through. I think because I'd seen my mum so upset, that was like a heart kind of in your mouth moment where you realised what was happening and what the possibility was.
Your sister Ruth painted a really moving picture of what it was like when that news kind of filtered through to her. She was on holiday in Paris with your mum and how she felt so protective and so scared for the reality of going on a tour. Joining up is one thing, a tour is quite another.
Yeah, it's the reality of being in the armed forces and particularly being in the Royal Marines. You have to live by your choices. It's very easy to stand in the bar and brag about the fact that you're a Royal Marine and sort of live the good parts of it. But you've got to take the bad parts of it. But it's not the bad parts. I mean, serving in Afghanistan was the greatest privilege I've ever had in my life.
You know, I'm thinking that's 6 months away and JJ's going to be fine because he's always fine. You know, since he joined up to the Royal Marines, to the reserves, he'd done all these amazing things. You know, he'd been to the jungle, he'd been to the Falklands, he'd been to forests in the pouring rain, in the mud, wherever he'd been, he'd always been fine. So I think you just have to think, yeah, he's going to be okay. You can't allow yourself to think that it's going to be any different, I think.
I was going to say, you can't really go around with your nerves on the outside of your skin all the time because it would be unbearable. So I think you have to be sort of cluelessly optimistic most of the time, don't you?
Yeah, I think you do. And it seemed very, very quick from hearing that he was going to the pre-deployment training being over and him being gone. And once he went off to Afghanistan, your lines of communication are really, you know, pretty minimal.
But what I will say this is all in hindsight, is that from where I was standing, it was so normal. You know, everybody, I was in the Marines, everybody that I had gone through training with, everybody that I worked with on a daily basis, like, had been to Afghanistan or was going to Afghanistan. It was just the job. So it's amazing how some might sort of term extraordinary can become very ordinary in those circumstances. But the important thing is that for my family, they weren't exposed to that. And so that's what I realise now.
This season of Relatively is sponsored by Find My Past, the online home of the 1921 census. In 1921, England and Wales were reeling from the Great War, and it shows in the census entries of surviving soldiers. Retired Army officer Harold Samuel Alpen apologised for typing his form, explaining that he lost half his right hand in the late war and cannot write properly. Another former serviceman simply wrote, "Ruined by war," in the section for occupation. How much do you know about your parents' and grandparents' lives in peacetime? Find out in the 1921 census, exclusively available online at findmypast.co.uk.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
You know, the story is familiar to a lot of people, but your tour in Afghanistan ended in you being really badly injured. The thing that you feared, not the most, but almost the most, perhaps, happened, and for your family. Can you tell me what happened from your point of view the day that it happened and what you recollect, please?
Yeah, it was the 27th of May 2011. I was a part of a big operation into some pretty dodgy neighbourhood. We were in a part of Afghanistan that hadn't seen much in the way of security forces, and it had been a lively week up to that point.
It was the day before my oldest's fourth birthday party, and she was turning four the next day, and the last time I had spoken to JJ was just a few days before, when he'd phoned to say, I'm going out on a special operation and I'm not going to be able to phone on her birthday, but I'm just phoning to say happy birthday to Tamara.
We were tasked with searching a suspected bomb-making factory because our big threat out there were these improvised explosive devices, IEDs. And so we were sent in to sort of secure and search this facility that we thought was being used to create these devices. And whilst we were conducting that search at 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, doing something which was very normal, I should say, very ordinary for that point in my life, suddenly a bomb was triggered. And it absolutely tore our multiple to pieces and sadly, ultimately killed three, wounded three. But there was just enough guys still there and still in one piece to get us off the battlefield and get me home eventually.
I remember I was off work. It was a Friday afternoon. My husband was upstairs in the bath and my youngest child at the time, I was going to get him changed and get him organised for kind of an early bath and bed and things like that. And I was just about to go up the stairs with him when my front door flew open and it was my mum who just said, you need to come now. The Marines are at the door. Something's happened to JJ.
What do you remember of the actual moment, the impact? Everything or nothing?
I took a big knock to the head when I was injured. It means that I remember sort of split-second images of the entire day. But at the point of injury, I just remember talking to my friend and then all of a sudden being on my back and just being in agony with my ears ringing, the dust settling around me. It really was kind of like a movie. And then immediately thinking, like, what has happened? All I knew is I'd been clattered really badly. And then, like, our training kicks in. It's that, right, first aid, you know, get a tourniquet on this arm, whatever it might be. But basically both my arms had come off, so there's nothing I could do for myself. So thankfully what I remember is that my friends jumped on top of me and they saved me. And that was what a thing.
We all raced to Mum and Dad's house and there was two Royal Marines at the house to basically say that he got to Camp Bastion at that point, so we just hoped that he was going to survive the night, really.
I was very lucky to come out of that. Well, I was lucky to be alive. But when I say luck, it's not luck. It's the work of incredible people who are very good at their job. It's not luck that I was surrounded by other Royal Marine Commandos who were extraordinary and they saved my life.
What were the injuries you sustained that day?
To sum up my injuries, both my arms had pretty much come off. My right elbow had been absolutely destroyed, and only about 2 inches of my flesh was holding my arm on, along with the nerves, just about. They were damaged, though, and the blood supply was just about intact. My left hand, I'd lost 2 of my fingers, but all the other fingers had come off and kind of needed stuck back on. I had a huge amount of nerve damage in both arms. I had huge amount of holes in my legs, and pretty, you know, every other inch of my body, but my legs in particular, they were full of infection, full of frag, full of dirt. My face had been crushed, my neck had been broken, my eardrums were burst. Just pretty much everything from the knees up on the outside had been damaged. And what I mean by that is, thankfully, because of my body armor and whatnot and helmet, you know, my internal organs were all right. I had a mild traumatic brain injury, but that was more from just getting banged in the head really hard rather than a trauma that had directly hit my head. Thankfully, my body armor, etc., had done what it was meant to do.
We just had to spend that first night not really knowing anything about any injuries or what to expect. So yeah, that was a long night.
Yeah, I was going to say a long night and also a surreal one, maybe.
Yeah, it was. My mum has spoken quite a number of times over the years about my dad struggling a lot that night. My mum was saying, we just need to pray. And my dad said, I can't. I just can't even pray. We just need to hope that everybody else is doing it for us. And they were. You know, there was congregations across Scotland. The news rippled through very, very quickly that something had happened to JJ. There was people sending messages saying, we've lit a candle and we're all praying for you.
Yeah, and hard, like, to see your dad. He's obviously been a bit of a rock of a man of faith to be in that position of not being able to sort of do what he probably wanted to do. That must have been hard too, I think.
Like everybody, when you struggle and there's something difficult, you try to turn to your parents. And our parents had always been the rocks, and they continue to be that for us. But yeah, it was a really difficult time. And, you know, once JJ did thankfully get brought back to the UK, once we got to the hospital, even at that point, my dad was just like, to the surgeons, well, you just have to fix my boy. You just have to fix him. You know, it was a difficult time, a really difficult time.
So he's back in the UK with some fairly profound injuries, but he then endured a lot of operations and rehab. And you're a nurse.
Yes.
You're a sister and a nurse. That's probably a little bit too much insight some of the time, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is a lot to take on. I remember my mum, her biggest worry was, what if I don't recognise him? Because we had heard that he had some facial injuries. She said, oh, I had to take a big deep breath before I went to see him. And then she came out a few minutes later, and the sense of relief on her face that he was there. And she just said, he's still JJ. He just still looks like JJ. You know, I went in with his, at the time, girlfriend Cornelia, who's now his wife. And I remember holding her hand and saying, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. It's still just JJ. When we got in, but I do remember the anaesthetist starting going over ventilator settings with me and how much pressure support he was getting and all these kind of medical things that I was thinking, oh, right, okay, I should be taking all this in because this is my bread and butter. But actually, you know, the most important thing to me was JJ in the bed. Yeah, that's definitely a moment of my life I'll never forget.
When I was still in a coma, it was the first time my Cornelia saw me was alongside my sister, and they went in together and she explained everything, and I think that helped. And then one thing I absolutely remember from such an early point in being in hospital, because I'd never broken a bone, never had a stitch, never been in hospital This was
that's one way to break your kind of hospital virginity.
Exactly. This is like, I am in and I'm in at the deep end. That's pretty classic of me, if I'm being honest. Yeah, exactly. So I'm all in on this one. I was astounded by the care that I was receiving around me. You're in so much pain. I mean, thankfully, you don't really remember the pain. You don't feel it. Well, I mean, I am still in pain, but not this level of pain. But I remember looking to the nurses and just thinking, you guys are incredible. And so I do remember pulling my sister in real close one day. And I just remember saying, you're an absolute angel. You're an angel for what you do. Because, you know, the work of a frontline, service of any form, but particularly of healthcare, is just unimaginable. It's so hard. Mm-hmm. It's so much responsibility. It's probably undervalued. But to the individual receiving that care, it means absolutely everything.
And to look at him now, he's zipping around the country doing a trillion things every 5 seconds, from Strictly Come Dancing to working as a reporter on The One Show and being mates with Prince Harry and everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
That day when you walked in with Cornelia, sort of white knuckle holding hands, to now, that must have been something that you didn't really expect.
No, not at all. I mean, it's been a roller coaster, I think, to be part of it, to stand on the sidelines, to help him to get where he is today. Because as much as all of this is JJ and his hard work and his personality that has got him where he is today, none of it happens without a big family of supporters behind him.
Mm.
And I think he would acknowledge that. Sometimes JJ might take a wee bit of encouragement from to acknowledge that.
We'll make him do it on this podcast. Yeah. We'll get it on tape.
Yeah, sometimes it might take him a bit of a persuasion, but he appreciates it. I know he does.
The physical adjustment is one part of it, but the mental adjustment post-trauma is in some ways the hardest part of it. Becoming dependent. I've been a Royal Marine Commando. We are very independent. Being someone that is now taking but not giving anything back is horrendous.
You know, initially he was completely dependent on people doing everything for him. And then there was a period where we had to help him learn to become independent again. And then there was times where he came home from hospital and he just wanted to go back to his old life.
And also the length of this was the sort of wrapping your head around the forever part of it. Has taken a long time. I mean, at first, because I still had my legs, so my understanding of getting blown up was you lost your legs and that meant, you know, your career was over. And so I still had my legs. And so I thought, excellent, patch me back up and send me back to Afghanistan.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I thought I would be back in no time. But the doctors were like, this is going to take like a year and a half to 2 years to recover from. And then I remember about 3 years later, a doctor saying to me, this is going to take about another year and a half to 2 years to recover from.
Oh my God.
And at that point, I actually like believed them. I was like, oh, yeah, I get this now. And then actually 5 years later, when you're medically discharged from the Marines and you think you're done, you realize, actually, this is never going away.
And what about your relationship then as brother and sister? It's gone through loads of iterations right up until that point, the injury. What about from injury to recovery to now? Has your relationship changed?
That's a good question. Probably a wee bit, yeah.
I would say that my relationship with my sister has never been challenged. That's the beautiful thing about it. She has been an absolute rock in all of this and was from the very beginning and was from the point before I even woke up.
The really acute times of his injuries, it did change. And there was some difficult times where we kind of had to have difficult conversations with him about how what he did affected other people now, because he was more dependent. And that's not what somebody in their early 20s wants to hear. Somebody who had been able to travel the world and go to Afghanistan, he didn't want to hear that actually what you do on a daily basis does affect other people in JJ, so you need to maybe be a bit more considerate about other people and think of others. So there were some difficult times.
I will live with my disability forever. Like that phrase that sometimes gets thrown around of, oh, and he overcame his disability. That's nonsense. You learn to live with a disability. You can overcome the initial trauma, but the actual disability is something that you need to learn to live with. And you know, like, look at, you know, it sounds like a silly example, but doing Strictly Come Dancing, it ultimately landed me in hospital because, you know, the physical exertion that I put on myself, but that's the reality of living with a disability. Now, don't get me wrong, it's the side effect of being alive. I'd rather take that and be able to do these things over the alternative, because the alternative isn't that I should be absolutely normal and non-disabled. The alternative is I should be in a box in the ground. Like, that. Let's make that very clear.
Mm. Now, I think, just how do you keep JJ's feet on the ground? You know, he is a guy now who, like you say, is friends with Prince Harry. He's travelling the world. He has more stamps in his passport than I will ever have in my life. And we always just say, well, you know, remember where you came from. And he's pretty good at that. But there's always moments where we have to say, come back to Earth, JJ. And think
get of... Get too big for your britches.
Yeah, don't get too big for your boots.
Listen, my life is very silly. Let's be quite honest about it. Of course, it's work. You know, I go and I graft and I do my bits and pieces. But some of it's pretty glossy and pretty fun. And I shan't complain. And yes, there is another part of my life, which is the bizarre stuff, like ending up at royal weddings. I mean, I always say that the William's royal wedding I listened to on a wind-up radio in Afghanistan. And a few years later, I'm now at a royal wedding. So that's absolutely bizarre. Yeah,
totally. I did sort of stir the pot a bit and say to Ruth, well, surely when you got back from the wedding, you know, you treated her to a slap up meal with some champagne to say thank you for looking after four children and an elderly person with dementia. And there was a bit of a silence on the tape, JJ.
I can't remember that far back. That would be the problem.
Very diplomatic, isn't he?
Do you blame your sort of brain injury leftovers for short-term
memory? Oh, yes, yes. That might be part of it. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's okay. I'll just keep a score and Ruth can email me when it's happened. It's fine. Right. Now, listen, on this podcast, I'm really interested in brother and sister relationships. What happens in the nuclear family if you shared a home when you grew up? But the sponsors for Relatively Find My Past, well, they're amazing. They can take your family right back. Having said that, here's an interesting fact. Scottish family history research is a lot harder than English. Did you know that?
No,
I didn't know that.
But happily, the 1921 census, all of that has been digitised and published just a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So I have family history research to share with you. There's no groundbreaking sort of bombshells. There's no EastEnders moment.
Yeah, okay. No, not Robert the Bruce. King Robert the Bruce isn't, you know, a descendant, that sort of thing, yeah.
Your grandparents, are they Isaac and Mary, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they are. Yep.
Oh, this is cool.
Gran and Papa. Troon Gran and Papa.
Yeah, Troon Gran and Papa.
Or Isaac and Mary.
Mary Ann appeared to have been married previously, according to the records.
Oh, according to the records?
According to the records.
No.
No.
Let's hear.
Right. Let's hear then.
I don't know who she was married to before, but when they were married, Isaac was employed as a shipping clerk.
That's right.
And their parents, John and Agnes, they are the ones that wrote in the 1921 census. They had four children. Isaac was the youngest.
Yeah, that's right.
John worked as an underground fireman for a coal mining company.
That's cool. Mm-hmm.
In 1921. So I'm thinking about like appetite for danger and service and physical work. It seems like something came through the genetic line.
Yeah. Isaac, we knew very well because that was the papa that lived with us. And what an amazing guy he was. I mean, one of the things that I loved about him was, so he died on the 2nd of April, is that right?
He did.
He died on the 2nd of April, which was the day after the tax year ended. So he finished his taxes, did all the books, and then went to bed and didn't wake up. So he was very diligent. You know, he did that stuff, but he couldn't change a light bulb, gifted in sort of being able to fix things or anything mechanically at all.
No.
Whereas my dad was the kid that used to, you know, I think he bought his first car when he was 13 or something.
Took it apart
and put it back together. And that's where I certainly got it from. But it's a virtue in this family. You know, Ruth's pretty good with her hands too. And I wish I'd got his financial brain, though, that's for sure.
Yeah, our dad loves us dearly, but he would disown us if we couldn't do DIY.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of quick fire questions then, if you don't mind. If you needed to wind Ruth up in an instant, sort of press her buttons and get her going, what could you do?
It's very hard to wind Ruth up, if I'm being honest. She's very unflappable.
Oh, I don't know. That's good. What would I do? I don't know. I actually don't know. He's so laid back.
She is a person who will just find solutions, fix things. And so I can't even think how I would begin to wind her up.
Probably, though, if you got in his workshop and you just disorganised his screwdrivers or his clamps into wrong size order or something, that would grind his gears.
Interesting. As you say that now, what I would say is that that is the perfect way of doing it. She's absolutely right. Everything should be in its place. Everything should have its thing. We like a good system. We like a good kit muster. It would wind both of us up to, the worst thing in my life. And listen, I've been to some scary places in my time.
I was going to say, where are you going with this?
I've done some scary stuff in my scale. Life. I've done some scary stuff in my life, but nothing terrifies me more than my Tupperware cupboard. Every time I go near that thing with something to put in it, I know just one touch and everything will come falling out of it. It's an absolute nightmare. It's the bane of my life. Yeah. And that has not got a system. That's the problem. It's the one part of my life that doesn't have a proper system. Oh,
but
that needs rectifying.
He's about to build his new house, and I bet you he makes a system for Tupperware.
Oh, I'll have a Tupperware
system.
You know, don't worry about that.
Like, I think probably one of my favourite memories, and JJ might agree or disagree, was when we used to go on holiday to France in the summer. Mum and Dad used to buy wine, and it had to be within the 72 hours of it coming out the bag into the bag and box, it had to be bottled.
As soon as we came home from holiday, the first thing we do, start a production line, and bottling it, up, and I'm talking hundreds of litres of wine.
And it was a proper...
What a thing.
Proper...
Yep. Like, everyone had a job.
Everybody had a job. And it was a very efficient bottling line, I'd say.
It was great. Love those memories.
Thank you to Ruth and JJ, and thank you too for listening.
And a huge thank you to our sponsors, Find My Past, who are offering you the chance to start your family tree for free. Head to findmypast.co.uk to find out more. That's findmypast.co.uk.
I mean, the funny thing is, she might not have said it, that Ruth's name isn't Ruth. Ruth's name is Jennifer. She's Jennifer Ruth Chalmers. Yeah, so they wanted to call her Ruth. And then my dad was sent off to the naming office, you know, to register the birth. And apparently on way, he thought, Ruth Jennifer Chalmers doesn't have as good a ring as Jennifer Ruth Chalmers. So came back and it was that way round. Now, that's how the story gets told. But I like to think that my dad had a moment and got it wrong. And I think that's probably more likely.
Enormous thanks as well to Tanita Tikaram for letting us use this amazing song. Additional research this season by Rachel Oakes, and sound design, as always, by Nick Carter at mixsonics.com. We'll be back next week with more sibling stories to share. There's a good tradition of love and hate. Staying by the fireside. There's a good tradition of love and hate. Staying by the fireside. No, the rain may fall. Your father's calling you. You still feel safe inside. Oh, no, your ma's too proud. Your brother's ignoring you. You still feel safe inside. Oh, was it solo? Was it yesterday?